So tell me about UG99.
UG99 is a variety of a disease called stem rust, which is the most pernicious and terrible disease of wheat. And since wheat gives us 25% of the world's calories, any disease that is that powerful and dangerous to the wheat crop is something we must be very concerned about.
Where is this disease now?
It was discovered in Uganda, UG, in 1998-99. So it got the name UG99. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's so dangerous is because it's a fungal disease which is spread by spores.
Mm-hmm.
And these spores blow on the wind. So there's no way to control where the wind blows. And the wind blew the spores of UG99 into Kenya, where it destroyed wheat in Kenya. And then it blew the spores across the Red Sea into Yemen. And then it blew the spores north up the Arabian Peninsula into Iran, where it has currently taken hold and where they've had terrible losses in the wheat crop because of this terrible disease. Now, if it moves out of Iran and it moves into India and Pakistan, It moves into the breadbasket of the Punjab, which gives us 20% of the world's wheat. Mostly little farms, which have really no defense. So what to do? Because once it jumps the Himalayas, it gets to China. The next stop is the Ukraine, Kansas, France, the world.
We're talking about the staff of life here.
Right.
Wheat, you would think that a disease threatening this very important staple crop, you'd think I'd have heard of it. And yet, reading your book was the first I had heard of this. How is it we've not heard about this?
We've not heard about UG99 because there's a terrible information gap in our country. The farmers have heard about it. The United States Department of Agriculture has heard about it. The Agricultural Research Service, which is a division of the USDA, they've heard about it. But the vast majority of Americans who just eat haven't heard about UG99. In fact, they haven't heard about any major agricultural issue, which was one of the reasons I wrote this book.
So what's our defense? What do we do about a disease like this?
We have very, very good defenses. A number of scientists from 40 different countries get together, and they have begun looking for traits that would impart resistance to the wheat, so that if the disease comes and blows on this wheat and it's got resistance bred into it, it won't get the disease, right? And immunity. Mm-hmm. The way to do that is to look into this network of seed banks, otherwise known as gene banks, which we have in this world for every crop, from apples to flax, and animals too. These are collections of traits and genes from different varieties of this crop. And when you need to find a new trait to breed into the old wheat to meet a new stress like UG99, you go into the gene banks and you look around for the right traits, and then you take them back to your breeding program and you rebreed the crop.
Mm-hmm.
And the man who I wrote about in The Viking in the Wheat Field was the greatest gene banker that we had in the world. He died in 2007, and his name was Bent Skovmund, and he was an expert on wheat and all the genetic relatives of wheat, the ancestors, the weeds, the local varieties, the spelt, the triticale, all the different varieties and relations of wheat that would give you the biggest possible genome from which to pull the traits that you need to defend the wheat against new stresses.
So the way we're going to fight back against something like UG99 or the next strain of rust that comes around is by having this genetic variety as tools in our toolbox. And this guy, the Viking of your title, he was one of the early proponents of doing that, right?
Yes, he was.
Tell me about him.
Bent Skovmund was a Danish scientist. He came over, studied at the University of Minnesota. And he went to work for a man named Norman Borlaug, who won the Nobel Prize for the Green Revolution, which distributed seed during the 60s to India, Pakistan, Turkey, Sri Lanka, places where there was endemic famine. And Borlaug and his associates spent their lives trying to find new kinds of seed that would grow bountifully in the developing world. And that was the Green Revolution. Skovmund went to work for Borlaug as a wheat breeder and a triticale breeder. And he went all over the world. He went to Portugal and Turkey and Rwanda. And little by little, he began to realize that what was needed was a superb collection of all these varieties so that when the weather changed, when global warming became a reality, which is another problem, that we would have the resources to rebreed the wheat of all these different countries. You can't solve hunger by sending wheat. You can solve hunger by sending seed. Big difference.
So what was it in his work that made him realize the importance of expanding and protecting these seed banks?
Skovmund was, like all the disciples of Borlaug, primarily a hunger fighter. These were people who really believed that endemic famine was not necessary in this world. That India, which had a famine, which killed 5 million people every 15 years, that that didn't have to happen. That if you could reorganize local agriculture and provide the kinds of wheat that would resist bugs like UG99 or drought or frost, that local agriculture could feed the people and prevent famine. And that's what they did.
You recount a lot of their work, and it's amazing in a couple ways to me. One, what real hands-on dirt farming kind of work they did.
Right.
And two, that a lot of the wheat varieties that we take for granted came about through amazing happenstance.
Right. I'll tell you a story. There was a very great plant collector named Jack Harlan who worked for the Department of Agriculture in the 40s and 50s. And he was out looking for wheat varieties in Turkey one day. And he found a lot of them, and he was gathering them. And there was one plant that was the ugly, he said, this ugly, downtrodden, kind of smushy plant that didn't have any beauty to it or any elegance to it. And he said, I'm going to put it in the bag, too. And he took some seed from it, and he brought it home. Some years later, there was a terrible outbreak of rust in the Pacific Northwest, in Oregon and Washington, really decimated the wheat crop. And the plant with the genes that had the resistance to the new strain was this ugly, horrible plant that Harlan had put into his sack in Turkey.
It's like the wheat version of the ugly duckling or something.
Exactly, exactly.
So the lesson here is save everything.
Save everything. And that's what Skovmund always said. He said, save everything, every weed, every rejected little plant that grew up on the margins of the garden that was shrunken and ugly and didn't look like it could provide anything. That could be the plant that you were going to need when the next disaster struck. And so that's what they did. And Skovmund worked in a system of 11 international seed banks that specialize in crops called the CG system. They're all over the world. We have in our own country a collection of seed banks, about 20 or 22 now, that specialize in specific crops. It's called the National Plant Germplasm System. This is the biggest secret in the world. And yet, these are the places with the genetic material that we need on a daily basis to save everybody's food security.
How are we doing, though, in terms of saving everything when there's such drive for monoculture, to just grow one thing and plow everything with that one crop?
The truth is that business loves monoculture. Nature loves diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we have monocultures of such enormous acreage in our country is because when a crop is profitable, all the farmers want to plant it. And the major corporations want to sell it. So the bottom line for people is always the thing that conditions agriculture in our society. On the other hand, if you have fewer and fewer varieties, of a crop, you have a smaller and smaller genome with which to rebreed the crop when disaster strikes. So we used to have 6,000 kind of apples. Now I think we have 50. The narrowing of the genetic base of individual crops is one of the most dangerous things for humanity in terms of meeting the crises that hit plants. So little by little, again, people like Skovmand have tried to gather the diversity so that when it goes extinct, there's samples left in some gene bank.
You know, in reading some of your descriptions about the seed banks, it kind of brought to mind, well, this is a zoo, you know, and it's nice to go see the animals in the zoo, but it's not the same as an animal in its real habitat. I mean, are we really saving the diversity if we're just saving stuff in seed banks if at the same time we're losing the habitats in the places of origin on the planet that gave us these crops?
There are many examples of saving seeds in what they call in situ situations, right in one is I was at a place in Israel called the Arbel Nature Reserve. It's like being in the Book of Ruth. It is, there's such old plants there. There's also new ones. There, you know, there's this khaki landscape of ancient wheat and barley. And in the middle are all these hollyhocks from England, remnants of the empire. That's a way of preserving ancient varieties. If you go to Colonial Williamsburg, you look in Colonial Williamsburg.
The guys with the tri-cornered hats.
And the reenacting the Revolutionary War. There's a garden in Colonial Williamsburg, which is very seriously tended by scientists who are preserving colonial varieties of tomatoes and string beans and other things that Thomas Jefferson actually ate. So this is not just a reenactment. This is the real stuff. And that is an in situ gene bank.
Hmm. So we're going to need these if we're going to whip UG99 and other forms of wheat rust. But what about as climate change begins to take effect? Is the variety that we have in a seed bank going to help us when the weather changes in our breadbasket?
Yes, it is. You know, in the middle of the 19th century, there was a terrible potato famine called the Irish potato famine in Ireland. And a million people died and a million people emigrated and the country was destitute. And one of the reasons for the Irish potato famine was there was one kind of potato was a monoculture, right? The very thing that we now know is so dangerous. The cure for potato late blight, which was the disease of the potatoes, came from a potato that was found in Peru. The gene bank today has got all the potatoes. It's got the ones from Peru. It's got the ones from Ecuador. It's got the ones from Ireland. It's got the ones that had the disease and the ones that survived the disease that for some reason have an immunity to the disease. And now that we've had a resurgence of potato late blight in our own country, farmers are spraying like crazy. They're going into the potato banks and in Wisconsin and in the rest of the world and finding the genes from these old plants that survived epidemics in the past. The same thing is happening with global warming. Global warming changes the soil, changes the water. It changes the environment in which the plant lives. So if you need to have wheat, for example, in Australia, where there's been terrible drought, that will survive terrible drought, you're going to go look in a gene bank. You're going to find a wheat that grew in Mexico in desert conditions in the last century with very little water. You're going to take some genes from that variety, put it into the Australian wheat. All this is very hard to do, I should add. I'm making it very simple. But this takes, you know, a lot of PhDs doing a lot of years of work. But you're putting those genes from the desert wheat in Mexico into the wheat in Australia, and that's how you will defend the Australian crop against global warming.
Now, when you're talking about taking the genes from one and putting them into another, mostly we're talking about through traditional selection and plant breeding.
Yes, but also now, biotech.
But now we can also do it with genetically modified organisms. What did your Viking think of genetically modifying?
Not to plants? Confuse, biotechnology is a process for moving one kind of germplasm into other germplasm, one kind of seed into or one kind of gene into another seed. It's not necessarily genetic modification. Genetic modification is the process of putting something into the seed that was never there in nature. Mm-hmm. So, for example, a benign example, is golden rice, where they have taken rice and in order to augment the vitamin A content, they've taken vitamin A genes from daffodils and put it into the rice. Violated, I think I read, 79 different patents in order to achieve this. That's genetic modification, but it's done with public money for the public good. The genetic modification that most worries people is the recombination of genes from different genera, animal genes with plant genes, human genes. I think Bent Skovmund never dreamed that somebody crazy or evil would get hold of this technology. Of course, that's what we have to worry about. It's not the great corporations are just trying to make money for themselves and for the farmers who buy their product. The thing we have to worry about most is that this wonderful technology, which could save the world from hunger, will be misused. But we have to worry about that with every technological breakthrough.
And Mr. Skovmund was clearly visionary when it came to saving seeds. He also was one of the early people to see this tension that was arising between keeping this information public versus the desire by corporations to make it private.
There's a story behind this, and it's worth telling even very briefly. In 1980, the Supreme Court ruled that forms of life could be patented and held privately as trade secrets. That meant that the great corporations in the chemical business had a kind of leg up on the seed business because they could reinvent seeds with new qualities and new traits based on what they knew of chemistry. So you have companies like Syngenta and BASF and Monsanto and Dow and DuPont going into the seed business. That is background. Skovmund was very much against the patenting of life forms. He said patenting a gene was like patenting every word in Hamlet. You'd have to pay Shakespeare every time you used a word in Hamlet. Because this is a gene. So 2, that's a nickel. B, that's another nickel. Or, that's another nickel. Right? To him, it was insane. On the other hand, it was a reality. It was part of life. Hundreds of millions of dollars were being meant and were being earned with these patented genes, and therefore hundreds of millions of dollars were being spent on research. And that's what the patent is for. It's to encourage research and invention. So we were stuck with this patent system. And now, because it has, instead of expanding agricultural research, it has narrowed agricultural research to those crops which bring a profit. So nobody's doing research to increase the genetic wealth of sorghum or cassava, which are the staples of the developing world. Whereas corn and soybeans and cotton, those crops are very, very much investigated and worked on by the private sector. Hmm.
So what is this privatization of the knowledge and the patenting of genes mean for this effort to make sure we have access to the diversity that we might need to fight back against crop diseases? Or
it's a big problem, because if you've got to buy it from a corporation, maybe you don't have the money. If it's held in the public domain, then it's free for everybody. And that's what was very important to Skovmann. Skovmann tried very hard, and this is at the beginning of computer technology, to put everything, every piece of knowledge from that seed bank on the web. Just at the time that Linux was doing open access, it was part of the same effort to create open access to information that should be held in the public domain. And he did everything in his power to put everything onto the web free. Once it's on the web, it can't be patented, right? Everybody knows it. But unfortunately, money talks. In research, it conditions what is done in universities. It conditions what is done by the government. And the amount of public funding that has gone into agricultural research has declined, I would say, catastrophically in recent years. The World Bank used to put up 30% of the money, and now they put up something like 6% of the money. The money for research comes from the private sector.
So he saw the threat that we might call corporatization of agriculture posed?
Yes, he did. He said after he left, he worked all his life in Mexico at this great international center for the improvement of maize and wheat in Mexico. And toward the end of his career, he went to Sweden, back to Scandinavia, and became the director of something called the Nordic Gene Bank. And these were the people who set up what we call the Doomsday Vault. It's the official name is the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, which is a vault under 400 feet of rock and ice in Norway on the Arctic border, where all the nations of the world have deposited copies of their crop seeds. And Skovmann believed that that was something that you had to have as an insurance policy against nuclear catastrophe, unlimited global warming. But in his everyday practice, what he felt was the most important thing was to set up local seed banks all over the world that were constantly collecting, sharing, exchanging seeds. His idea, and this is what he put into practice in Mexico and everywhere, was that you would write to him and he would say, I have a problem with aluminum in the soil. I have tropical soils. I'm Brazil or the Congo. And I need to get some germplasm which will help me. And Skovmann would send it to you for free because he had public money and public research. But he had one codicil. When you got through growing your new plant, you had to send him back a sample. And you had to send him back all your field books with all your research so that the next breeder down the line could have free and open access to your work as well. And that created a real international coterie of exchange among scientists. And that is the thing we must preserve. The danger of privatization is that you take these brilliant people, you pull them out of that, and you lock them up in St. Louis with a great salary and a lot of wonderful resources, and they don't share what they know because it is owned by someone else.
He also struggled from time to time against the restrictions of socialist governments and communist governments who wouldn't allow free flow of ideas for completely different reasons.
That's right. I have this in The Viking in the Wheatfield, too. There's a story of an expedition to Tibet, which was so fascinating. It was a Canadian expedition, a couple of Canadians, a couple of scientists from Syria, people from Czechoslovakia, from India, and Skovmann. And they all went to Tibet at the invitation of the Chinese government in 1990 to go find wheat that grew at these phenomenal heights, 17,000, 16,000 feet, these wonderful mountain valleys. So they go and collect all this wheat. And the deal was that you were supposed to split it. The host country, which is China, not Tibet, because Tibet is part of China, according to China, that the host country would keep half and the visiting scientists would keep half. So they collect it all, and the Chinese say, okay, we're going to send you your half. Go home. Goodbye. Uh-huh. And they go home, and they're waiting, and they're waiting in Mexico, and they're waiting in Ottawa, and they're waiting in Aleppo. And, of course, it never came. It never came. Got locked up.
And then once they do all this amazing field work, and some of it is like Indiana Jones level of adventure to bring back a seed, then they have to make sure their work is kept safe, and often it isn't. It disappears if a storm hits one of these seed banks, or they're simply mismanaged. What do they do about that?
It's a terrible problem because when you're talking about a seed bank, Skovmund's seed bank in Mexico is a gorgeous building with wonderful local art in the front foyer. You come in out of the bright sunshine, you put on a down coat, and you go into a sub-zero, way sub-zero vault with wonderful shelves that move around. But in Rwanda or in Iraq, the seed bank is a couple of houses with a couple of freezers, and the genetic wealth of the crops of the country are in those freezers. Well, in Iraq, for example, and the same thing happened in Afghanistan, some thieves heard there was a bank. They showed up to rob the bank, and they were very disappointed when all they found was a bunch of seeds, which they poured out of their containers, threw in a terrible muddle in the floor, and that was the end of the Afghan seed bank. Luckily, those seeds had been copied, and they were in other banks in other parts of the world, out in Davis, California, and in the United States and in Mexico, and they could be replaced.
You also relay a story here about Russian scientists who, during the Nazi siege of their city, starved to death rather than eat the seeds that they were.
This is an amazing tale. There was a great Russian plant collector named Nikolai Vavilov, really one of the great, certainly the greatest botanist of the 20th century, who had a huge collection in Russia. During the war, two things happened. Stalin imprisoned Vavilov, and he died in the gulag of illnesses related to starvation. It's hard even to say, since this was a man who had fed millions and millions of Soviet citizens with the plants that he had brought back. The people who were guarding the collection in under the Nazi siege, during the Nazi siege of Leningrad, they were all starving in that city. They could have eaten the seeds. They could have planted them and eaten them, and they didn't. They starved. There were three people that starved to death at their desks, literally, not to give up this collection of all the germplasm in the then Soviet Union. The heroic nature of things that happened under these terrible conditions in Russia is really just beginning to come out. It's now, of course, Vavilov has been resurrected as a great hero. He's on postage stamps, and he's a great hero of Russia.
And I guess the ultimate expression now of these seed banks that will be safe no matter what is this so-called doomsday vault. Tell me about that.
The doomsday vault is different from these other collections because it is what we call a base collection. It's a place where you just keep it. You keep it and you keep it, and you keep it into eternity. Other seed banks, like the one in the in-situ one that I described in Williamsburg, or the ex-situ one that I described in Mexico, they are constantly changing and exchanging, getting new seeds, sending out seeds, multiplying seeds. They are constantly changing their collection. The Svalbard collection, the doomsday vault, is for doomsday. It's for when we screw things up so, as human beings on this planet, that we have to restart agriculture all over again, which I hope is a day that never comes. But it is a sign of the times that such a collection even exists, because the end of everything is implicit in the existence of this collection, the potential end of everything. That's a cautionary tale, if ever there was one.
So what do you think is the takeaway lesson from learning about Mr. Skovmann's life and work?
The takeaway lesson for me, and I am an urban woman, I am a New Yorker, was that we can no longer allow agricultural policy to be made essentially in secret by a few government officials and a few corporations. We have to learn about the national plant germplasm system. We have to learn about the CG system and all these gene banks. We have to understand what makes agriculture go, what makes food security possible. If we can do that, then we can join the civic conversation about what should be American policy regarding agriculture. And then we aren't separate from the farmers. We're in one country with the farmers, really, one political and social country with the farmers. We are all citizens of the same polity. We're all rained on by the same rain and shined on by the same sun. And I wrote this book because I wanted people to know about a great public servant and what it takes to make a great public servant. And I wanted people to become engaged in the civic conversation that controls policy in this country.
The book is called Viking in the Wheat Field. Susan Dworkin, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.